So he says to us, now look, you people, you've got a place at the table. And he said, things are going to get bad and they're going to get ugly. They're going to get really ugly. And he said, and you can get angry and you can even fight back if you want to. And he said, but the one thing you can do and you can never, ever do is threaten to leave. You cannot threaten to leave now that you have a place at the table. And I just remember thinking, he's telling us, like, the generations before us have found us a place at the table. We are not leaving that place at the table. So wow. It was powerful singing Just As I Am, having just heard that talk.
Out of Lamb of God, I come, I come.
Boy, have I got a treat for you today. We have a special guest, Lori Iserloh, who has been instrumental in working for LGBTQ plus inclusion in the Episcopal Church. She's going to tell us a lot of her story. You may think at first that this is really not about you since you're not a church person, but you are already entirely wrong. What we're going to hear from Lori is not just the details of what happened, which she is really good about, but that she's going to tell us about their strategies, about the emotional journey that she went on. If you think this is a time in which there needs to be change or you feel discouraged, right now is the time to listen to what Lori has to say. It is remarkable. It is passionate. It is intelligent. It is detailed. And it is thoroughly entertaining with a deep sense of emotion to it. You have lucked out if you've already listened so far. So please don't quit. I didn't know exactly what to expect. So I recorded an hour and a half with her and thought I would whittle it down to 45 minutes, but no going, Doug. What we did is we actually split that hour and a half interview into two 45-minute episodes, and you will thank me for it. So please sit back, relax, sip something out of your brand new, what was that in your hand? Is that your new, the Heartburn mug? Yes, I just got mine in the mail. It is ridiculously beautiful. I'm not a big mug guy. I actually kind of swore I'd never make mugs, but I'm drinking it. It's some little coffee mushroom, not that kind of mushroom, but some of these smart brain mushroom coffee mixes. And I can tell you, I love this mug. It's making my day right now. And if you review, you don't even have to give us a good review, but if you just review us on Apple Podcasts, I will be randomly selecting people for two prizes. We have a new one to announce today. Prize number one, you'll get a mug or any merch off of the Heartburn set of merchandise, including the tote bag, or you can get any single piece of merchandise off of Doug Thy Neighbor on my Etsy store. I also wanted to tell you about a brand new grand prize. So one person from August, and it'll be from the August contributions only, one person will be selected at random and will be eligible for a two-hour experience design consultation so that we can help you plan an event, a wedding reception, a wedding, an engagement, a church service, a picnic, a engagement, whatever it is that you have planned that is any kind of experience, a haunted house. We'll give you a two-hour consultation that is usually a $1,500 value, and I will bring in at least one of my assistants to assist me with it. So at random, I will be selecting exactly one person at random from anybody who actually writes a review for us on Apple Podcasts, pulling from that and giving you a two-hour consultation, again, worth $1,500. I'm so glad you're here today. I've listened to this over and over and over again, probably more than any other single podcast we've put together so far. And I absolutely love it because there's so much to learn and you're about to do that. So thanks for being with us. I hope you guys know how much I appreciate you thinking along with me, but when we get to the end of these two episodes, I feel almost confident you're going to thank me. Last thing I want to remind you about, besides subscribing and reviewing to get your prizes, is we are very close to having enough questions and voicemails to do a Dear Uncle Doug episode. I would love to engage your questions. So please go to theheartburn.net and leave a voicemail for us with your question, or write Dear Uncle Doug. It could just be an idea. It could be an ethics question of any kind. It could be a big one, a small one. It can be something that doesn't seem like a big ethics question about how we use this product or that product. It can be something about a simple relationship. It can be something about being stuck spiritually, or about a breakthrough you've had spiritually that you just are interested in commentary on. You can write to DearUncleDoug@gmail.com or go to theheartburn.net and leave a message, and we will get that going. But now, let's listen to Lori Iserloh about how she changed our world.
Well, thank you. You were so eager right away.
I'm happy to talk.
I couldn't be happier about that. Mm-hmm. I love you to death. I know you mostly from church, mm-hmm. but specifically the Queer Virtue Group.
Yes.
Is where we got to know each other mm-hmm. a little bit better. In fact, I had Sarah Capostasy up here, and I already posted her podcast, her episode.
Oh.
She's amazing.
Yeah, she is. I love Sarah.
And a deeply spiritual, beautiful human. With this podcast, actually, so I've done, you know, whenever I invite somebody, I like to do a little bit of research, just kind of get to know. And you're a tricky figure, and I'll tell you why. It's kind of lovely. Everybody has something to say about your character and about your friendship. And not a lot of people know what you do. And that's partially wonderful. This, our pattern here is usually to start to talk about stuff that usually overlaps with people's careers, and that's just their passion area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's your thing? And I know you work as a lawyer. Yes? And,
I'm a lawyer. Mm-hmm.
And you work for the county?
For the county. Mm-hmm.
And how long have you done that?
I've been a lawyer for, since 1991.
Okay,
I've been with the county for about 10 years. So.
And what specifically do you do for them?
I'm over their labor and employment law section.
Great.
Yeah.
But what we care about is like what your passion point is. And if I ask other people, would you call yourself an activist?
I am an activist. Now, I don't talk a whole lot about my work because obviously my work is pretty heavily influenced by attorney-client privilege.
Right.
So
yes.
I just don't talk about it.
Right.
But I think how people know me at St. David's, I'm a lifelong Episcopalian. I've been at St. David's about 20 years. Back in the early 90s, I was the executive director of the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby of Texas.
I want to make sure we catch that. And actually, I'm just going to push this a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Make sure.
Yeah,
you're going to be comfortable.
Back in the early 90s, I was the executive director of the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby of Texas after Glenn Maxey ran for public office. He was my boss.
Lesbian and Gay
Rights Lobby. Okay. LGRL. Okay. It's now called, what's it called now? I can't remember. Equality Texas.
Okay.
But it was LGRL. And so I did that, and then I started practicing law. And when my son was going to be born, we came back to the Episcopal Church. And when I got there, I was, I love St. David's, but I was concerned about where the church was in the Episcopal Diocese of Texas on full inclusion of LGBTQ people. And I knew that it was almost like a calling. I knew that I had the kind of experience in the Episcopal Church, because I'm a lifelong Episcopalian, right. Plus the work as a lobbyist for a pretty mainstream organization. I knew I had some skills and abilities to help in that transition in a way that would be beneficial for the church as a whole, not just for gay and lesbian and LGBTQ people. So I knew I had some skills to bring to it, and I really felt it as a calling. That's how people know me.
Yes.
So back in the I guess, let's see, what year was this approximately when I really felt a call? It was probably 2003, maybe just before Gene Robinson. So he was 03, so it was 02 or 01.
But it was before Gene Robinson.
It was just before Gene Robinson.
Context. So
yes.
Can you just paint a picture then? What was life like? What was going on? Give us some context for 2002, 2003 for people that don't remember it.
Well, in the church... let's talk about in society as a whole. Gay marriage was not legal yet, or same-sex marriage was not legal yet. Some states, Vermont in particular, did have a kind of a domestic partner provision. You could register your domestic partnership at Travis County, but that didn't really have much legal effect on it.
Right.
So that was as a whole. Now, in the church, there were two kind of headwinds working against us. One was that in the Episcopal Diocese of Texas and in some other very conservative dioceses around the country, there was a canon called Canon 43, and it prohibited partnered people who were in same-sex relationships who were partnered from serving as priest in the diocese. And it was pretty insulting. So that was one issue. The other issue was that the church was not, there was no way to get married in the church or partnered in the church or have your relationship blessed. Now, that was no great big surprise there because, of course, there wasn't no marriage anywhere. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So in the middle of all that,
I think by then there was a few really progressive churches that did something like the UCC church.
Maybe so.
And the Unitarian, which is outside Orthodox Christian progressive.
That's right. There were some, but the Episcopal Church had not gotten there yet.
Right.
And although we were just really, I mean, it seemed very difficult to us at the time, but, you know, we had, Jeff Lutz came and talked to our group at St. David's, and although we felt so kind of bedraggled and everything, and like we'd never, ever be able to accomplish any of these, he reminded us the Episcopal Church was light years ahead of the other mainline churches at the right. time, so that was very helpful.
In part because, like, Canon 43 would say if you were partnered, you couldn't be ordained. But I think at least the Episcopal Church would ordain people that were openly gay and celibate.
That's right.
And other churches at that time would not, still, some churches mm-hmm. would not consider actually membership if you're openly gay.
Yeah, I think that's right. And certainly the Episcopal Church had, by that point, in early 2000, had heavily embraced the laity, the ministry of gay and lesbian partnered laity, right? So that was all good at the time.
Yes.
But there was a lot that was needed to be changed. And so here I am coming into the Episcopal Church. And just so that you know how I came back to it again, because I think it's kind of interesting, I had basically left the church when I was probably about 16 and had been first without any, you know, really spiritual home. And then at some certain point, I had become a Buddhist and even taken refuge vows as a Buddhist. Although when I did it, I remember talking to someone about it. Yeah, with Pema Chodron. And I talked to a guy.
I'm sorry, with
Pema Chodron?
Mm-hmm.
Famous. And I had taken refuge vows with and specifically to her at the time or in her presence. And so this, I remember, though, I talked to this guy and I said, you know, I feel kind of funny because my spouse and I are trying to get pregnant, or not spouse, partner at the time. She and I are trying to get pregnant. And I just feel kind of funny because I was brought up in the Episcopal Church. I remember he told me, this is out at the Shambhala Center in Colorado. He said, oh, the Episcopal Church, you will go back to that well many times. So I...
About what year was this?
1999. Yeah, maybe 1998. Okay. So I went back to Austin. Jess did get pregnant. Yay, that was good.
And Jess is your partner.
Jess is my partner, my wife at the time partner. We've been together 30 years, so we'd already been together a long time at the time.
Right.
And so Buddhist thing never really, I mean, she liked it fine, but it wasn't really, you know, working for her. I was doing a walking meditation at the Austin Shambhala Center, and I love the Shambhala Center and the people there. I think it's a tremendous path for a number of people. I've got nothing negative to say about it, except that I was there that day, and there was a youth meditation garden. I remember it was the tiny little patch of earth, and it was all shriveled up. It's probably this time of year. And I thought, this is not enough of a youth program for someone who's about to have a kid. Now, everything at the Shambhala Center may be completely different now. In fact, I suspect it is. I suspect there's a lot more parents with kids there now. But at the time, there were some, but not just a ton, right? And so so I'd kind of put that in my mind. And at the time, Jess, my spouse and partner, said to me, you know, with this baby on the way, my grandmother's going to expect the baby to be baptized. I remember exactly where we were in the car when she said it. And I said, okay. And I said, how about the Episcopal Church? Because I've been raised in the church. And she had, her father is an Episcopalian. She grew up in Episcopal schools. And I remember she's paused for about 15 seconds. And she said, yeah, that'll work. So.
Real intense discernment.
So we had been to a party, and I think maybe a little before that, you know, women's party, lesbian party. And there was a woman there. It was late at night, and everyone's having fun, music's playing, and it's just a great party. And this woman had said to us over the din and noise, you need to go to the Compline service at St. David's. It's really great. And so we went, and we loved it. But that's all we had done there. But I went to San Antonio one day. I could see I'm from San Antonio. And I came back and Jess said, you know, I went to St. David's on Sunday morning. And she goes, we know so many people there. It's really, really great. So, you know, we decided we better go talk. It was September, so it was this about this time of year, a little bit later. Talked to somebody there, and we walked in with Ron Smith, and we sat down with Ron, and we said to Ron, here we are, we're lapsed Buddhist, lapsed Catholic, lapsed Episcopalian, and we want you to baptize our baby, and we don't know why.
So your religion at the time was lapsed.
It was lapsed. I think I was in lapsed Buddhist at the time. I was still practicing. Good. And so Ron Smith, he looks at us, and he goes, you're perfect. I remember he just said, you're perfect. You're perfect. And so we said, oh, really? And so he said, yeah. And so we said, he got in my mind, now this is probably a little bit of a dramatization, but he took out this big book, and St. David's was under construction at the time, and we were in that old house next to it. And he dropped it on the table, and this cloud of dust went up. And I said, what are you doing? He goes, well, we better set that baby's baptism. Those spots can really fill up for that. So we set the baby's baptism.
So it was a schedule. It was a calendar book that he was opening.
It was a big old book, a calendar book. So we set the baby's baptism. And then we go back talking. And he said, okay, so, you know, like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but is this the first place you looked? And we said, yes. And he goes, well, you need to go look at St. James. But we're still perfect. And you're perfect for us. So we said, okay, we'll do that. And I said, so don't we need to take a class or something? And he said, class? Like a class? And I said, yeah, some sort of class for the baby or something. And or for coming back. And he's like, you're both confirmed, right? And I said, right. He's like, there's no class.
Yeah.
So we came, he said, just let's call my church in San Antonio, transfer your letter and move it here. And that's it. That's all we do. So we set Oliver's baptism on the Feast of St. David, which it is in March, usually is in Lent, so they don't baptize. That year, Easter was really late. And so we could do it. And they said it then because he was born in over the holidays, and the flu season is such that you don't want to have the little babies, tiny babies out.
Yeah.
But we didn't want to wait till after Easter, so that's why it was set then. But it was also a huge day at St. David's. We invited, it was Theo was retiring that day.
Who was the previous rector?
No, he was I think it was his name. He was worked at the front desk for years and years and years.
An icon of the church.
Yeah, he was.
Before
Peter Hahn.
Yes, before Peter was there. Yeah.
So he was retiring, and we invited a bunch of our lesbian friends because we didn't know that St. David was going to fill up pretty well anyway at 9 o'clock with baptisms. And my mother bought a little flask of holy water from River Jordan that they mixed in with the water. And Jim Bethel, he came out in this, you know, head to toe in brocade, and he was a big man anyway. And he hugged my mother, and Ron Smith said later, I bet your mom's been going to Episcopal churches all her life, and she's never been hugged by a priest before. It was funny. So we do this whole thing, and, you know, there was another gentleman there who was a little iffy on the two-mom thing, but as soon as my mom poured out that bottle of holy water, he's like, whatever you people are, I like you. So,
whatever you people are.
Whatever you do, I like you.
It's probably more complicated than that.
Okay, I've got more news, and this time it is huge. It is still true that anybody who stops and writes a review on Apple Podcasts between now and the middle of September, once a week, is going to be eligible to have your name drawn to get some merchandise from The Heartburn. That's a shirt, a t-shirt, a hot pink tote, or a mug, or anything from the Etsy shop, Doug Thy Neighbor. But this is new. Now, through the end of August, anybody that writes a review of any kind on Apple Podcasts is going to be eligible to be drawn for the grand prize of a two-hour consultation about an experience design. That's me and one of my assistants from the Xanatos Gambit Meta Detective Agency. They were the ones that do all sorts of weird, crazy designed experiences for people about their lives, and we will help you put together an anniversary dinner, an engagement party, a wedding reception, a family reunion, a haunted house. Whatever kind of experience you're designing, we are going to make it amazing just by having a little bit more conversation with you. So stop and review and make things great again.
Be more.
We had Oliver's baptism, and I heard Jim Bethel say many years after that, he was back visiting St. David's. He said, you know, now we have gay marriage in the church. He said, but I'll tell you what, the precursor of that, first we had to have Oliver's baptism. And it was, I'm telling you, just to get it done and make Jess's grandmother happy, if they'd have said, you know what, we're not ready for this yet, we would have said, fine, let's do it anyway. But to set it at such a big key service and have us there with all of our friends, it was a real game changer.
And so many people there. And Jim Bethel, that name is also key. That is of the Bethel Hall.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, Jim Bethel was the a longtime rector of St. David's, part of David Boyd.
And it was part of the whole extensive building project. Very beloved, as I recall.
Very beloved, yeah, beloved.
And there's a chapel named after him. And this is a very extensive building project. One of, like, two major phases of the church,
yeah.
If I recall.
Yeah, there was a big building project. He really had helped us do, well, I came in at the tail end of the Capitol campaign. That's when we joined St. David's, because I remember I said the church was under construction when we met with Ron Smith. But he wanted to get us all set for it through the Capitol campaign, but I believe he was gone by the time it was finished, that he had gone on to retire, if I recall.
Context!
Okay, at this point, it actually makes some sense to tell you a little bit about what St. David's Episcopal Church is. It's not just the church that we attend, but it's got some very important history. It was actually established in 1848, and it laid its cornerstone of the building that is still there and that we still meet in 1853. Now, to put that into some context, the Civil War is 1861 to 1865. So this is an old, old church. This is just, 12 years after the Alamo that this congregation started. And one of the things that's really important is that in 1856, the church split really over slavery. There were two separate churches. By 1859, one church had a building and the other church had a priest, and neither could afford the other things, so they got back together. So the church had split and come back together in less time than before the Civil War even started, and when Texas seceded from the Union. Now, this is not to say that this reunified church had resolved the racial issues. On the contrary, they had not. It was in 1941 that 16 African-American students at Tillotson College, which is a historical Black college in Austin that is now called Houston-Tillotson College, that they actually tried to start a church, and they eventually ended up settling on a church on 7th Street, what is now 7th Street, just down a few, like, couple miles from where St. David's is, and started a completely separate congregation. And that is almost 100 years later. These racial struggles affect everything, and they touch all of us, and certainly they do directly impact LGBTQ+ inclusion in the church. And that's why our history becomes so important as we continue to have these kinds of conversations about inclusion and about community going forward. They're theological, they're historical, and they're ours, all of them. Now, Texas has an even more complicated relationship with race and with emancipation. That is something that you should definitely look up, and so I highly recommend it. The other thing that's really important to know is that given our history of division, the church has remained a kind of diverse church. While it lacks some kinds of diversity, it is really a good chunk Republican and conservative, and a good chunk of liberal folk, and they were early to do same-sex blessings, and there were rich conversations about it. So this is a community in which all of that is happening at once, and it's happening. So when you hear Lori talk about the experience of being in the church and having a relationship with different bishops as they come through and different issues that they're addressed, you can see this community was impacted in a really powerful way. It also is the context for her to build some of the bridges that she'll continue to talk about.
So Oliver's baptized, and Ron says, this is an important precursor.
Jim Bethel has said that.
Jim Bethel.
Yeah, yes. He said that years later. So Oliver's baptized, and we start going to the Bethel service, and someone said, are you out at church to me? And I said, I don't even know what that means. Like, I've got this little tiny baby. I'm showing up on Sunday morning exhausted. I'm just happy they're making coffee. I am out, but it's like not even like been on top of my mind is just like getting there and getting through this, you know,
surviving
a baby and working full time.
What did it mean to be, sometimes I get the sense that just what it meant to be out at that time was different to it's now. It can be an identity marker that you can wear easily anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Being out back then was sort of a matter of fact, but you wouldn't necessarily wear a t-shirt, make a deal of it, announce it. It was just something you kind of were or weren't. Am I correct in that, or how is it different?
Well, you know, I guess I came out in the 80s, and at the time, it really was a matter of wearing a t-shirt or jewelry or whatever. I think some people, not so much in my age, but a little bit younger, tattoos or whatnot. But by the time in the early 2000s, it was a little different. I mean, it was definitely, you just were yourself. I mean, and we didn't, Jess and I were there with our baby. So it was, there really wasn't a matter of kind of being out. We were out and we lived our lives as we were. Very joyful times for me personally, for Jess and at St. David's. Then in 2003, so I guess that was what I'm talking about right now, was 2000, so 1999 to 2000, Oliver was baptized. In 2003, there was something happened, and that was that the people of New Hampshire elected an openly gay man who was partnered to be their bishop, Gene Robinson. And Vicky, his name was Vicky. His parents, when he was born, he was such a low birth weight baby, his parents thought he was going to die. They thought they were going to have a girl, so they named him Vicky. But, you know, the doctors and everything, that baby's just going to die anyway. You don't need to pick another name for him. He's not going to be around. So they left his name as Vicky Jean, but he didn't die. He lived.
Wow.
So yeah, it's a beautiful story of Gene Robinson. But so he was kind of set to become the Bishop of New Hampshire, but he had to be approved by General Convention. And so I get a little bit ahead of myself, but that was coming down the pike. So at a certain point, I had realized, you know, this church is great. I love St. David's. We're so welcome. We're enjoying it so much. But there are some changes that need to be made here for the good of my family, but also for the good of the church. Now, St. David's has got some chops when it comes to being able to bridge people of different views. And you mentioned the Civil War. St. David's did split during the Civil War, with half supporting the North and half supporting the South. Was able to come back together after the Civil War was over.
Which I understand was mostly because two congregations couldn't afford two priests.
Yeah, they had, one side had the building and the other side had the priest.
So, great tastes that taste great together.
Yeah, those were good things for them, building and priest. But I just had a sense that it could happen. And I remember very clearly to this day, Sunday afternoon, being in my kitchen, and I just had this moment of, there's work to be done here. And I'm feeling the call to do that work.
Mm. When was this?
That was probably 2000 or 2001. I think baby wasn't really small then. It was probably 2000. It was before B. Gene Robinson was elected, but not too much before that. So,
but you're feeling a call, and how would you articulate that call as to fight for rights?
No, it wasn't really a fight so much. It was more of a, there's work to be done, and I have some thoughts on that, how that work could be done. And not only that, there was a little bit of a sense that became stronger and stronger that this work is not going to be easy, and it may not even necessarily be something that is, I don't know, that's satisfying or that I'm going to necessarily be successful in, but I'm going to be doing this work, you know, and
whether it succeeds or not,
whether it succeeds
the call
or not,
was clear.
Whether I like it or not, whether it's particularly good for me or not, this work is my work for a little while. So I just remember, so clearly where I was standing in the kitchen, and I know sometimes I kind of, you know, laugh a little bit at people who talk a lot about a call from God, but I really was a sense, I had a sense of the call. So I decided what to do with that. So I ended up, as luck would have it, and I don't remember what brought this on, I called Yana Osborne on the telephone. And Yana's a priest here in Austin. She's retired now. She's Danish and very progressive and is still and was then a tremendous friend to the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. So I called her on the phone and I said, this is just something I'm wanting to work on. What do you think? And I remember she didn't even ask me a lot of questions. She just said, okay, so there's two people you have to meet here. And they're very different people. She said, one is George McGonigal, and he's here at St. David's, and he's conservative, but he loves the church, and you've got to meet him. The other one you've got to meet is Muffy Maroney. Now, she's from Houston. She is extremely progressive, and some people like her ways. Some people she rubs the wrong way, but you're going to have to meet her. So Yana and I went out to breakfast with George over at the Stephen F. Austin.
The conservative man, George McGonigal.
A member of our church to this day. He had been one of the longest serving members, and maybe ever, on the executive council, or maybe it was on the, as a general convention deputy.
Which would be, that is some of the hierarchy of the Episcopal Church.
At a national level. Even at an international level, yeah.
Oh, wow, okay.
And he had worked for the National Church in New York. And he was really good friends with Louis Crew, who's one of our... I mean, you know, I do this work and I stand on the shoulders of giants, and one of whom is Louis Crew. David Talbot is another one. And there are many others. But George and Louis Crew knew each other from working at the National Church. So I had, when Yana and I sat down with George that day, there had been something that happened at General Convention, and I don't remember what it was anymore, but it was definitely an issue that had split conservatives and progressives. And I remember that I sat down, I can't believe I did this to this day, it's foolish. I was younger then. And I said to George, so what side of this issue are you on? And he was on the opposite side from me. And I confronted him about it. And it made him mad and made me mad. And we both started to walk away. And Yana, being like the Danish mama, grabs both of us and she's like, sit down, just sit down. So we both sat down. And we just kept talking. And now George and I are extremely close, and we have become very close over the years. But that was our early days. So then he and I started meeting separately at a place called Paradise, which is funny. It's Hamburger Joint on 6th Street, Paradise, and talking from our very disparate views. And
So on a regular basis?
On a regular basis. Wow. We didn't have lunch together. And
I kind of have to pause to say, that's a little unheard of right now.
I guess it is a little unheard of right now, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, without people who really come to adulthood after Facebook, I think it can be hard to imagine. I mean, one of the biggest points of conversation, and what I've offered workshops on, is how to not talk about things when you go home to be with your family. So not talking is something of a survival technique. Mm-hmm. But you are intentionally going and sitting down and at a burger joint and actually confronting your differences.
We were. And we were trying to find, I mean, because the thing about George, and he and I, he would say this, he was sitting in this room. Over the years, we have found that we have much, much more in common than do we have differences.
Right.
Now, if we had just gotten up that first day at the Stephen F. Austin at brunch and been mad over whatever and walked out the door, and if Yana hadn't said, sit down and talk, I don't know. I mean, I just can't tell you the benefits that have come to the church from my relationship with George McGonigal.
So that moment with Yana...
It was key.
It's key. Mm-hmm. And if she had not advocated for you to...
Sit and be together and hold our differences, I don't know that George and I would have... I mean, maybe we would have. We might have seen each other at St. David's and said, hey, let's start over or whatever. But I don't know. We might not have. Yana, she saw it in the moment. She saw it in the moment. And told us to sit down and talk. And Yana being like the Danish mama, grabs both of us and she's like, sit down, just sit down. So we both sat down. And we just kept talking. And now George and I are extremely close. And we have become very close over the years.
As I sit here, I can't help but wonder who it is I need to sit down with. We'll be right back.
In all seriousness, this is big news. Anybody that will stop and do a review on Apple Podcasts now through the end of August is eligible for the grand prize drawing of a 2-hour consultation, not back-to-back, but we'll do a beginning and after consultation with me and one of my other experienced design artists from the Xenatos Gambit Meta Detective Agency. This means if you're planning on getting engaged, if you're just planning on taking someone out to an anniversary dinner, or you want to create a special event at your church, or you want to rethink a service that you're planning, we will help you. This is something that we would charge up to $1,500 just for the 2-hour consultation, but we will listen to your needs. We will help you plan stuff. We'll get your feedback on it and help it be as great as we can possibly be. And all you have to do is stop and take for a moment and just tell us what you think, whatever that may be. Write it down here at Apple Podcasts and listen to us anywhere at the 9 places that we're posted. But this contest really applies to the Apple Podcasts. If you will do it now through the end of August, you are a contender, and I would love to be able to spend this time with you and help make your life sort of a little bit more designed and amazing in what you're going to experience. Thank you so much. I don't know how to end this, so I'm going to keep talking until I just
call. Was for the good of the whole church. That you said that a couple times.
Yes,
that
it was
really clear. You're not just fighting. I use that word because I particularly think that doesn't apply to you.
No, it doesn't.
You were not fighting for one community.
No.
You were advocating for the good of the whole church.
Yes.
Can you tell me what does that mean to you, and how were you clear about that as opposed to doing it a different way? Or,
well, I don't know how clear I was. I think I was not super clear on it at first. What really started getting me clearer on it was was a diocesan council that I missed, actually.
The diocese is like a district.
It's the district. It's the district that Texas is in. And I had missed this one, but some of our straight friends at St. David's had gone. They were delegates, and I'm a delegate now. At the time, I wasn't. And we had asked a woman, we were having like some conversations on full inclusion, and we'd ask a woman, Seja Raquel, who's a friend of mine, who's a therapist, to come in and have a kind of a discussion group. It was the same one that brought Jeff Lutz in, same series.
And tell us briefly who Jeff Lutz is.
Jeff Lutz he was the founder of Soul Force. And Soul Force is a group, an LGBTQ group, but I think mostly of gay and lesbian people, who advocate for the full inclusion of gay and lesbian people in evangelical churches, really the Southern Baptist, but those big Southern evangelical churches.
Yeah.
So they have not had a lot of work in the Episcopal Church. Integrity has mostly done that work.
Integrity is the LGBTQ group for Episcopalians.
Yeah.
And we'll put a link to Soul Force and to Integrity and to Dignity and a few other groups that I can think of in our notes for this podcast.
Good, good. And Integrity has now has recently changed its name to Rainbow Episcopal, but it's still Integrity. That's what it was at the time. But anyway, we had Seja come over to St. David's, and she is my friend who's a therapist, and she started telling us about just kind of how to live in a circumstance where maybe you aren't being fully included or fully accepted. And I remember our straight friends came to talk to her, and I remember them being tearful at how bad diocesan council had been that year.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, "Ooh, no, 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 no! Whatever has happened needs to stop happening. I don't know what it is, but I need to. The call is bringing me there." So I got elected to go the following year.
I don't want to skip over.
So I mean, not the following year. Soon thereafter.
Soon after. Mm-hmm. But I just also, there's a moment here.
Mm-hmm.
You brought in a therapist
mm-hmm.
to help people endure,
mm-hmm. endure
being in a situation.
Yep,
that was necessary.
Necessary at the time.
Just how to survive, because it's not going to be as hospitable as it needs to be.
Yeah.
And so how to just endure it is. And there were straight people at that?
They came to us that day. They came. It was really mostly gay people, but straight people came that day because they had experienced such upset. And I think that might have been right after Gene Robinson. I'm getting a little bit of this mixed up, but it was rough. So let's talk about Gene Robinson. So 2002 rolls around. Gene, I don't think that he had been, maybe New Hampshire had their election that summer. Anyway, but General Convention was to meet in 2003. And any of these priests and bishops, those of you who aren't Episcopalians, you got to know, in the Episcopal Church, we are electing bishops. We are electing them.
Right.
And so Gene Robinson was duly elected by Diocesan Council in New Hampshire. And he had to be approved by General Convention, which is also all elected people. So he had made it through phase one. He had not made it through phase two at the time.
And the electing party of the national, or the largest level, the General Convention, is a combination of a body of priests, is that right?
Priests and laity and bishops.
So there's two different bodies, is there not?
One is laity and priest, and the other is bishops.
Bishops.
Okay. Mm-hmm. House of Deputies, House of Bishops.
Okay, and so both of those have to approve.
They have to approve. So I had, in talking with Yana and talking to George, she had also introduced me to a woman named Muffy Maroney from Houston, Texas. And Muffy always says that. Muffy is also a lifelong Episcopalian. She's a grandmotherly type. And she's just seen enough of this, guys. I mean, she's just impatient with it, and she wants it to change. And Muffy and Helen Havens, who was Muffy's good friend and was the rector of St. Stephen's in Houston, they really started helping me to get connected with people nationally, including Susan Russell, who at that time was over something called Claiming the Blessing. So there
Claiming
were,
and Blessing.
Claiming the Blessing. Claiming the Blessing, yeah. And it was because at that time, there was a movement to allow the Episcopal Church to not marry, but at least bless the relationships of partnered gay and lesbian people. So there was a big conference in St. Louis of integrity, and I went. People gathered from all over the country, and Claiming the Blessing was one of the issues there. But the other issue was Gene Robinson, because they knew that New Hampshire approved him. He was going to go to General Convention now. And we were... remember the name of that. I'm sorry, I just blanked on his name. The president of integrity at that time is embarrassing. I'll look at it in a minute.
I can look it up, yeah.
Yeah, Michael. His last name just escapes me for a second here. But he was, I remember we were speaking at this old kind of cathedral style church in St. Louis. And I remember he said, "You're never going to forget this moment. And we're going to sing Just As I Am." We're doing altar call. And he said, you know...
Which is a very Protestant summer camp sort of thing of inviting people to come down to the altar rails and pray. I grew up with that.
And we never do this in the Episcopal Church. So it was very unusual. And we're all singing. So he says to us, "Now look, you people, you've got a place at the table." And he said, "Things are going to get bad and they're going to get ugly. They're going to get really ugly." And he said, "And you can get angry. And you can even fight back if you want to." And he said, "But the one thing you can do and you can never, ever do is threaten to leave. You cannot threaten to leave now that you have a place at the table." And I just remember thinking, he's telling us, like, the generations before us have found us a place at the table. We are not leaving that place at the table. So it was powerful singing Just As I Am.
Just as I am, though tossed about with many a conflict, many a doubt, fighting fears within, without, O Lamb of God, I come, I come.
So, you know, we all do the altar call, and it's beautiful. And then General Convention starts, and I go with Muffy Maroney. We go to General Convention together, and Helen Havens from St. Stephen's in Houston. And, of course, St. Stephen's does approve. I mean, I'm sorry, General Convention does approve Gene Robinson. And it gets, let me just tell you, it gets ugly. It gets ugly to the point that you just don't think you can listen to it anymore. But you turn on NPR, and it's on NPR. You turn the nightly news,
it
and it's on nightly news.
It was part of the... Do you know what year exactly this was?
That was 2003.
And it was part of the regular news cycle for days on end. This was not small. It was national news.
Mm-hmm.
It was on every channel. It was CNN. And it was regular. People, or I should say media, loved the fight.
They loved the fight. And it was an ugly fight, you know, with people on both sides, but... saying some things that I probably think they, you know, wish they hadn't said now, but they did then.
This strikes me as important in part because a lot of people who will probably be listening to this podcast are not Christian and have asked me, there's a question of Christian visibility a lot,
mm-hmm.
that how come all we see are jerks? why, you know, mm-hmm. and in this, this being an, there's, you've already mentioned several exceptionally beautiful moments, especially, I think, when, and tell me again who said it, that said, we're going to sing Just As I Am and You Cannot Leave.
That was, now that was Michael, and I'm just going to have to look up his name. He was president of Integrity.
I'll look it up, yeah.
At the time, dang, what was his name? Yeah, I mean, the spirit is in this, but you know, the spirit, you've got to make room for the spirit. And yeah.
And that's a powerful, beautiful moment, mm-hmm. but it's not one that the press is interested in. No. So the press wants is the fight, and so that's
they
part
want
of the reason
fight.
That we see the division mm-hmm. is a better headline than singing Just As I Am.
Yeah, they don't want that. So, but we do. So we go to General Convention, and it's rough, it's tough, it's miserable. I remember I called a friend of mine when I got back, and I said, I just don't know that I can stay with this. And I remember he said to me, Laurie, the church is not just one bishop. Mm. And so it was, I mean, you know, it's like it wasn't our bishop, who at the time was pretty strongly opposed to Gene Robinson. It's not just Gene Robinson, it's more than that. So when I came back from General Convention, our bishop, Don Wimberly, wrote a letter saying that over, you know, basically he was never, ever going to allow a blessing of same-sex relationship or same-sex partners, same-sex people to, or people in same-sex partnerships to serve in the Episcopal Church.
Wow.
Now, I have understood later that was some sort of brokered deal. If it was, I wasn't aware of it. It was really hard to hear. And he sent, that letter went to every single person in the diocese. And there I am with my kids, my time, my talent, my money, and my kids in this church. And I thought, this is not good. And so, as I mentioned, I had a call, and the call was, it's going to get ugly. And it did get very ugly then. Mm. So I finally decided, I guess in 08, no, maybe 06, right after Hurricane Katrina, so that was probably 06, that I was going to try to go to diocesan council, and I did from St. David's. I don't remember if I was elected or a visitor. I might have been elected. And I was watching some of the debate on the floor, and I realized that it was very unsophisticated, and that it was not only helping the cause of full inclusion, even from people who are wanting to help it, it was hurting the cause and it was hurting the church. And I thought, we've got to bring just some more civility. We've got to have some more civility in this. Something that's kinder. I mean, we have got to have more in common than this. It was just ugly. I mean, church people acting this way. No. And it was just the way that something like Canon 43, which says, and that's what it was all about. It was trying to get Canon 43 repealed so that at least same-sex people who were in partnered relationships had a prayer of serving. That's all we were trying to do. Not even saying that they were going to serve, but at least they had a chance of serving if the bishop said it was okay. So I was just at a loss. And I was at a loss with some, you know, some folks who were on both sides of that issue. Like, how to make them cool out. I don't know what to do. So I went around for a couple more years not knowing what to do. And then they had another general convention. It meets every, this is our big national conference, and it meets in this time in Los Angeles. So I go again with my friend Muffy, and I'm there. And I'm walking around a general convention. It's at a huge conference center right outside of Disneyland. And it's a great general convention. But I walk out the door, and this man bangs into me, just pops into me, like we just run into each other. And I, you know, we kind of, I mean, really, like, banged into each other. And I'm like, so are you okay? I'm fine. You okay? Yeah. So we start talking. Well, his name is Joe Reynolds, and he's the dean of the cathedral in Houston. And so after we bumped into each other, we start talking. And we start talking about our concerns. And our concerns are, not only are the discussions that we are having at Diocesan Council back in Texas, not only are they bad for the cause of full inclusion, they're bad for the church, they're bad for us as Christians. They are not helping our souls to fight like this. Mm-hmm. We both have this vision, Joe Reynolds and I do, and we bumped into each other. Edge of the bench. It's So we start talking, and we start looking for other like-minded people. And there was another gentleman at General Convention, a guy named Jim Cowan, who was friends with Muffy. He was an attorney for Shell Oil. Very skilled attorney.
For Shell Oil?
Shell Oil. Yeah, Shell Oil in Houston. And he and I were having a glass of wine at one night, a gay guy. And he's also got this vision. Like, we cannot keep going fighting like this. It's not seemly for us as Christians to be doing this. And it's going to hurt the church. It's going to hurt us. So then we've got three. We've got Joe and me, and we've got Jim. And then we meet Lisa, who's the new, she's the new rector at St. Stephen's in Houston. And so between the three of us, the four of us, we start having conversations about what can we do to cool out the conversation? Not even how can we move it forward. How can we cool out the conversation at Diocesan Council so that people are being constructive and not tearing into each other anymore?
So what I'm hearing is at this point, this group, and this is the people you mentioned are all gay and lesbian or LGBT?
No. Jim Cowan and I are. Lisa Hunt and Joe Reynolds are not. They're priests. But they're priests. I mean, he's the dean of the cathedral, and Lisa is the new rector at St. Stephen's in Houston.
And one of the shifts here is that the passion that you, the vision that you have is really unity. I mean, not
the
agreement, but it's to keep, we're not leaving the table.
No one's leaving.
So we have to be better at this.
The conservatives aren't leaving. We're not leaving. No one's leaving. We just got to figure out how to do this deal, how to fix it. So
it's how, not how. If or what.
No, it was how. And so Muffy Maroney, who I mentioned earlier, very graciously offered us her ranch, which was between Austin and Houston, for us to meet. And we were doing that. And we had a number of people involved. Jim Stockton, who is the rector here in Austin, Sarah Kapostowski, he mentioned earlier, Muffy herself, Terry Heller, Rhea Kopening. We had a number of people who came together to talk. And I won't say that all of our vision was always unified, but we were really trying to figure it out. So as time went on with that, Andy Doyle is elected as the Bishop of the Diocese of Texas. There's a lot of joy about that. I was very joyful with that. I would have been fine with any of the elected ones that were at the top two, Dina or Andy, but it was Andy, and I was very joyful. But he came to St. David's then, and he told a big group that he was not going to offer leadership on this very difficult issue. And it was a rough meeting.
Mm.
It was a very, very, very rough meeting. It was a big group of our parishioners there. And here we are. We're at a church that split apart over slavery in the Civil War. And you're telling us that you're not going to offer leadership on an issue that's splitting our church apart right now. So that was bad. And I really didn't know what to do about it. And we had Catherine Jeffers Shorey, of course, was our presiding bishop at that time.
That's the head bishop of the
She's the head bishop of the whole church. She was at the Anglican Consultative Council, which is an international global group, including African churches and Asian churches in Europe, the Church of England, Ireland, Scotland. She had been ostracized by them. There was a moratorium on any more bishops who were important to relate, moratorium, any more partner bishops being asked to serve. And I was just feeling so betrayed at the time. I felt betrayed by the church leadership and by Bishop Catherine Jeffers Shorey. But then I went online one night, and it was really just the darkest hour. And I saw a woman from Nigeria, and she had posted online, and she said, you know, Episcopal Church, I know you're thinking about leaving the Anglican Communion. Please don't go. We need you. We need you here. It was a rough time.
What we do here is we have hard conversations. and we do it with love. Because the love of a Nigerian woman online in the middle of the night can make a really big difference. Your love can too. That's the heartburn.
Just as I am, though tossed about with many a conflict, many a doubt, fighting fears within, without, O Lamb of God, I come.